Today for Australia after China, what's next? Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, World Notice Post, covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour and with a philosophical overlay. Today, I'm joined by Salvatore Babones. Hello there.
Hi, Martin. And today, maybe a little political philosophy.
Well, I think so. You know, philosophy covers everything. The beauty of philosophy is that you can unpick anything you like, right? So whether it's politics or economics or science, there is always the philosophical overlay, or as I prefer to look at it, the right lens to look at everything. So maybe
well, they have the courtesy to call me a doctor of philosophy, even though I've never taken a single class in the subject. So there you go.
Well, I hold a master of philosophy from Oxford as well. So there you go. It's just one of those things. Now, on the assumption that the relationship with Australia and China is going to remain relatively sour ahead, and the fact that we've put so many eggs in the China basket, the real question that I'm interested in exploring is, what should we be thinking about with regard to the next cab off the rank? And it seems to me, I could be wrong, but India perhaps should be, or indeed is, a potential target. What do you think?
Well, where I sit in the higher education sector, of course, people have been talking about India for the last 5 years, that what next after China? The answer has been India, that they're going to go to India for students to staff the class, you know, to fill up the classrooms. In higher education, we've actually already over-binged on India. And I think that was apparent last year when there was an ABC Four Corners documentary on Indian students centering on Murdoch University, but also covering other universities, showing that while Chinese students could largely pay their way to come to Australia, these are mainly middle-class Chinese students who can well afford to pay tuition in Australia, the Indian students were having to work dozens of hours a week, off the books, illegal work, in order just to pay their tuition, because they didn't really have the finances to come to Australia. And that just belies the fact that India is a much poorer country than China. It's around $2,000, about $3,000 a year GDP. China is sitting at, well, my estimate would be $8,000 a year GDP per capita. Official numbers are $10,000 per year GDP per capita. No matter how you look at it, China is four or five times as rich as India. Or to put it another way, China is 10 years farther ahead in its growth curve than India is, if you think India is catching up and will follow the Chinese example. But despite the fact that, you know, India is 10 years behind China its growth curve, it's only been 2 or 3 years behind China in its number of international students in Australia. And that's why we ran into problems there.
Right. So the university sector is leading the curve ahead, possibly, or maybe it's a bit more complicated than that. Right. I mean, you know, India is a large country. So therefore, right, you would think, well, there's plenty of people there. So surely we can do quite a lot of business there and perhaps beyond education. But there are some things there that you might want to sort of question. I mean, okay, they generally, some of them speak English, which is, you know, right, positive, probably easier than actually Chinese speaking. But what proportion do speak English? And are we right in thinking that India is as big or bigger, or, you know, how does it compare in terms of population with China?
Well, a high proportion do speak English of some kind, and the same might be said for China. You know, neither country has a lot of highly fluent English speakers, but in India, there is an entire English language media, which doesn't exist in China. And so the English language media in India is the most prominent media in India. It's, you know, the most prestigious media in India, and almost everybody involved in politics and the media in India, at least at a high level, would speak English. In terms of raw population size, India is about to overtake China. We don't have very good statistics for India, but the estimates are that we'll overtake China in population sometime in the next 5 years. Both of them are sitting at just under 1.4 billion people. The difference is that China's population is 1.4 billion and falling, while India's is 1.4 billion and still rising. Now, India does not have the kind of explosive fertility rates that we find in places like the Middle East and sub-Saharan Africa. India's fertility rate is somewhere around, I think, 2.5 these days. So that's 2.5 children per woman on average, which means the population is growing at a healthy clip, faster than any Western developed country is in terms of natural increase. But it's still not in any danger of runaway population growth. And in fact, that population fertility rate in India, rather, has been slowly declining really for the last 40 years. Whereas in China, of course, the fertility rate is hovering down around one, optimistically 1.5. China's very cagey about the statistics because in the light of the end of the one-child policy, this has become highly politicized. China now has a two-child policy, but really it's been desperately trying to get people to have two children, and people really have, for the most part, wanted only one child in China. So while China has a declining population, India continues to rise slowly, so that by the end of the century, India might be sitting on 1.5, 1.6, 1.7 billion people. That said, they're poorer than China. So by my estimates, if you use $10,000 a year is just a rough cut for what it means to be global middle class. Now, obviously, in Australia, on $10,000 a year, that's 13,000 Australian dollars a year, you would no way be middle class. But of course, living expenses are much lower in India. Standards are different of what people expect to be middle class. Usually by middle class, we mean, can you afford your place to live and a vehicle of some kind? And, of course, food on the table, that sort of thing, education for your children. And by my estimate, based on data from the World Top Incomes database, which is a database based on tax receipts, actually, in different countries, India has about 1/8 as many people who can afford a middle-class lifestyle, earn more than $10,000 a year than China does. So that just puts it in perspective how much poorer it is. 1/8 as many middle-class consumers makes it a much smaller market than China's. Still bigger than any other emerging market in the world outside of China. It's the world's largest, or second largest emerging market, but it's still a small market compared to China's.
And that means that if you were thinking of India as effectively a growth engine, it probably wouldn't be in consumer land in the early years. It would have to be more on the industrial side or in terms of infrastructure, wouldn't it?
Well, that is true. But of course, Australia is not a major exporter of consumer goods. So from Australia's standpoint, other than education and tourism, which of course are all on hold due to the current crisis, other than education and tourism, what is Australia going to sell to India? Really, two things, iron and coal. And India is already a large importer of Australian iron and coal. Now, Australia could look to expand that to agricultural products, but that is very problematic because of the different dietary customs in India. I'm not sure how well Australian beef would sell in a country where most people don't eat beef as a matter of religion. Yeah. Of course, there are other opportunities, and Australia does have vegetable exports as well, non-meat exports and dairy exports. But there are opportunities in agriculture, but they're a bit complicated, and I'm not enough of an agricultural or culinary expert to really say what they would be. It seems like the biggest opportunities for Australia really are either in services like education and tourism, or potentially in media. And of course, that's where the interesting possibilities are, because Australia is, like India, and an English language media market. In addition, Australia has a large Indian minority population right here in Australia who could potentially be producing media content for India. And this should not be overlooked. I mean, the United States has become a major purveyor of video media to India, both through Amazon Prime and especially through Netflix. Amazon Prime has a Hindi strategy, so they've put all their resources into pushing out Hindi language content. Netflix has actually gone broad and has produced content in, I think, something like 8 or 10 different Indian languages, Hindi, Gujarati. I actually don't even know all the languages of India. Most people will be aware India is a widely multilingual country. I mean, Hindi is the unifying language of the country, but you can start with Hindi, Gujarati, and Bengali and then go right down the list. There are a whole series of languages. I'm not even familiar with most of the South Indian languages from the Deccan in South India. So these are all large markets that are potentially accessible both to English language media coming out of something like, you know, a place like Australia, but also to potential what we would consider ethnic or specialty broadcasting coming out of Australia. And I think that's potentially a real opportunity for Australians if they want to seize it.
Right. But what I'm getting a sense there of is that, yeah, there may be some opportunities, but it's not really going to be a replication of the last 20 or 30 years vis-a-vis China, is it?
No, absolutely not. Mainly India is seen as a defense partner, as a security partner, more than as an economic partner. Mm. The economic relationship, I believe, is probably already overexploited with India. That is, in gross terms, I don't think there are a large number of opportunities in India. There are niche opportunities, you know, medical equipment, like I said, in media, but these are not large-scale opportunities for capitalizing on growth in India. Mm. But as a security partner, of course, India is very attractive, especially because it's perceived as increasingly having a confrontational relationship with China. And if an enemy of an enemy is your friend, well, then it looks like Australia's in luck.
Right. And, of course, there is that border strife going on at the moment. As you say, if, in fact, China is getting antsy with Australia, then being more friendly with India makes, I guess, some sense to Australia.
Well, we had the spectacle in May of two nuclear-armed countries facing off with sticks and stones across the border in Ladakh, which is in the far west of India. And it's a good thing they kept the sticks and stones. Of course, both sides are under firm orders not to use firearms, which is why the deadly primitive weapons, but nonetheless deadly. I mean, you know, several dozen people killed, at least 20 on the Indian side. It's rumored 30 or more on the Chinese side. A very vicious conflict. India, in response, has hit back at Chinese internet apps. So it's prohibited dozens of Chinese apps, including most prominently TikTok, from operating in India. And of course, there are movements across India to boycott Chinese goods. And all of this has roots that go back way back to the decolonization of India and the non-demarcation of the border between India and China, which eventually led to a war in 1962 and now has led to an undemarcated, undefined border called the line of actual control, which simply means this is where we are.
Right. So it sounds a bit shaky there on the border. And look, the comment you just made earlier on about two nuclear powers, that really put a chill through me.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, of course, Pakistan is also nuclear armed. Yeah. So the big threat, I mean, if there's ever going to be a nuclear exchange, it's very unlikely it's going to be between Moscow and Washington. It's far more likely to be either between India and China or India and Pakistan. Now, Pakistan and China are very close allies. People might be surprised to hear that if they think that the U.S. has been involved in Pakistan. And Pakistan actually still flies F-16 fighters. But that U.S. alliance with Pakistan, well, it wasn't an alliance, partnership with Pakistan, really was, you know, a circumstantial product of its time during the Cold War. Pakistan hasn't really received much U.S. aid since the Afghan debacle. Of course, Pakistan was host to Osama bin Laden, which didn't make any friends in the United States, and it certainly didn't make friends in Pakistan when the U.S. went into Pakistan to ultimately to kill Osama bin Laden. Mm. So, you know, Pakistan-China has been the enduring relationship. They always say it's like lips and teeth is the metaphor the Chinese like to use. They don't say who's the lips and who's the teeth, but they do say that it is an unshakable alliance. And in fact, most people think of North Korea as China's number one ally. And I would say no. In fact, China's number one ally in the world is probably Pakistan, which doesn't make India feel any more secure.
Mm. And what about the trade relationships with Australia and India? Is there a trade agreement or anything like that in place? Or how does that work at the moment?
Honestly, I'm not aware. You caught me off guard with that. I don't think there's an Australia-India agreement, but the trade is really mostly at this point based on minerals. I mean, India is a big importer of coal, which means Australia. And of course, India is one of the world's major steel producers. If China weren't the overtowering steel producer in the world, we would think of India as the world's steel giant. But compared to China, they're small fry, but they're still very important as a market for steel, for iron. And I believe Australian iron goes to India, though, as I always remind people, commodities like iron go into a global market. So whether this year the Australian iron goes to India or to Japan or to China makes little difference. Iron from somewhere else replaces that supply. The point is, India is a major consumer of iron and coal, which of course boosts the Australian economy.
And is India building lots of power stations? And are they using coal for those power stations? Or are they going solar? Or what are they doing?
Well, they should be building lots of power stations. Like most democratic countries, and India is a democracy, these get held up, not in my backyard, NIMBYism. They get held up by political battles, held up by corruption, held up by court orders, you know, all sorts of things, even endangered species. In India, there's been a big issue over land rights for building power stations and factories, for that matter, indigenous issues. So India, like Australia, has indigenous peoples who have ill-defined but nonetheless explicit rights in the Indian constitution. So there are all sorts of reasons why India has not been able to build the power capacity it needs. Now, the obvious choice for India is solar. I mean, we talk about solar here in Australia, but there's a lot of controversy over it. India, however, is in the situation where the areas that need the power are also the areas that have the greatest sunlight. It would not be so much of an issue for India. And in fact, I've written on this, that India should be investing more heavily in developing a solar manufacturing capacity, to be able to build it, to be able to build solar panels themselves at scale. Right now, they mainly import solar panels from China or import kits from China that are then assembled in India. And the big controversy in India has been, developing an indigenous solar manufacturing capacity. India clearly has the technological know-how to do so. Whether it hasn't because Chinese solar panels are simply so cheap, or it hasn't because of being tied up in political infighting, I'm not really sure. The government has a big, ambitious solar power plan. Again, to do this in terms of large-scale generation, I'm not talking rooftop solar in individual homes. I'm talking industrial-scale solar. But so far, it hasn't happened. It's been trickling out in India, and India does rely heavily on coal instead at this point.
Okay, very interesting on that. And clearly, there is a potential there to go solar, but different way of thinking. I guess a couple other questions. What about the brain drain? So, are indigenous people there who are basically, well-trained and well-educated then likely to leave and try to go to other places? And is that a problem for India?
Well, of course, there's a big brain drain to Australia and to the United Kingdom and to the United States. Go to Silicon Valley in the U.S. and every other engineer is Indian. It's a massive brain drain. That said, it's different for India than for China. I mean, for China, people are trying to escape the country and escape its regime so that when Chinese engineers are able to emigrate to Australia or the U.S., I mean, yes, there may be a tiny fraction who become fifth columnists and spies for China, but 99.9% of them are thrilled to escape China's totalitarian regime and build a better life for themselves in Western countries, in democracies. For India, there's not that escape element to the migration, so that India benefits much more, I think, from its diaspora than China does. So Indian entrepreneurs are much more likely to spend 10 years in Silicon Valley and then start up a company back in India. So I think that brain drain is not as damaging for India as it is for China. Now, it's a one-way ticket when it comes to, say, medical doctors. I mean, we all know how many medical doctors India exports to Australia, to the UK, to the US. And that, of course, compromises India's health system. But that's an inevitable fact of, that's an inevitable ramification of having a good education system at home and open borders, and, people can leave. They'll go back to India when and if India develops. But for that crucial engine, the crucial issue of engineers and tech people, I don't think it so much damages India as benefits India, because they're building connections that then will help India develop its own industries.
Okay, well, that's interesting. And I was just thinking also about the political aspect, right? Because I know I've read some stuff that suggests that India is becoming less democratic and, you know, in some ways less open. What's your read on that?
Well, it's difficult to say as someone outside the country. So take my view with a grain of salt. But I think we too often listen to only the intellectuals inside a country instead of listening to the entire spectrum of opinion. So if you listen to the US, US American intellectuals, well, you would think America is already a dictatorship under the thumb of Donald Trump, who will not allow elections to go forward in November 2020, because many respectable publications like the New York Times or Washington Post have published opinions that, that suggest the U.S. is no longer a democracy. In fact, very famously, there's a letter circulating right now in Harper's Magazine signed by, again, something like 100 U.S. intellectuals saying we have to end the deplatforming and we have to stop all these recriminations because, and this is the part no one's reporting on, Donald Trump poses a real threat to democracy. Okay, so again, India, we have the same sort of messages coming out, but these are messages coming out from an intellectual class that is highly aggrieved at the victory of the Hindu nationalist BJP party. Now, the BJP does have its roots in a Hindu nationalist organization that is somewhat analogous to, say, the Muslim Brotherhood in Turkey, which, you know, is the roots behind the Erdogan regime in Turkey. The difference is that unlike Turkey, India does have a, you know, vibrant free press. India does have, you know, rule of law and elections and turnover in power. Now, it does have some mismanaged policies. Now, the BJP has been populist, has been very, you know, has been unafraid to use, well, to use Hindu nationalism as a route to gain votes. And that has led to people, not necessarily the government as such, but to people who are supporters of the BJP, perhaps being hostile to Muslim neighbors. And when I say hostile, I don't just mean tisking them. I mean violence and in some cases killings. I mean, there have been inter-ethnic killings in India. We shouldn't overestimate the scale of it. You know, we're talking about tens, 20s of people dying in inter-ethnic violence, which in a country of almost 1.4 billion people, while regrettable and really horrific for those who are on the butt end of it, nonetheless, it's a very small number. It's kind of like when we talk about, again, when we talk about Black Lives Matter in the United States, there are a very small number of African-Americans who are killed by police. That doesn't excuse it. That doesn't make it right. It's just to put it in perspective that most African-American men are not killed by police by far. And it's the same in India. India is such a friendly place to be Muslim that, in fact, India, a big issue in India has become Muslim immigrants from Bangladesh, Afghanistan, and Pakistan fleeing the Muslim regimes in those countries to relative freedom in India. So while I don't endorse the inter-ethnic conflict in India, by far from that, I absolutely condemn the inter-ethnic conflict in India, I think we can see the government's inability or even unwillingness to repress or to prevent that kind of violence as being a failure of governance more than a failure of democracy. The BJP is popular. Narendra Modi is, the story really is true that he's a Chaiwala who rose through correspondence school. He didn't go to one of the top Indian institutes. Instead, he got a correspondence degree, both for his bachelor's and his master's. Now, in the days he did it, the correspondence degree means that he did it by mail. We're not talking online learning. We're talking he got his learning materials in the mail, did his homework, and sent it in to be graded. In the 1975 emergency, which I always remind my intellectual colleagues, which was essentially an imposition of single-party rule by the Congress Party under Indira Gandhi in 1975, Modi had to flee. He actually, there are these famous pictures of him dressed up like a Sikh, wearing the turban and beard, so as to escape capture by the police. And of course, most members of the precursor to the BJP and other parties in India who were non-Congress parties were put in prison in 1975 by the Congress Party, which is the party of the Gandhis widely perceived in the West as the good guys, so to speak, the liberal Indians. Well, those liberal Indians were the ones who 40 years ago were putting their opponents in jail and promoting one-party rule. Now that we have democracy in India, of course, democracy is messy. And, you know, I don't for a minute endorse the kinds of inter-ethnic conflict that have been stoked by the BJP. But I do want to put it in perspective. It is nowhere near the kind of inter-ethnic conflict we see in failed democracies like Russia, like Turkey, where, you know, even though there are elections, we can't take them seriously, where, you know, in Turkey, opposition Kurds are simply jailed en masse, right? There's nothing like that going on in India. India is self-correcting like other democracies. It does things wrong, but it's fixing them. And I think that's reason for hope. I think we should see the BJP government in India as one that has a strong democratic mandate that doesn't necessarily share Australian values, but then those are Australian values. I think they do share, broadly speaking, the values of the Indian people who continue to return them to office.
Mm. So as we bring this conversation to a bit of a closer, I just sort of wanted to then say, it seems to me from what you're saying is that whilst in theory India might be quite an attractive target from an Australian perspective in terms of trying to actually power up trade relations and those, actually, it's not going to be another China, is it?
No. I mean, there is no second China. China was a one-time story of an area of the world that had been artificially cut off from the global economy for decades. I mean, for more than 50 years, that then rejoined the global economy. And that, of course, simply led to the reconnection of linkages that had existed before World War II. I mean, we often forget that China was deeply engaged in the Pacific world, that American investment in China and British investment in China were both very extensive before 1949. All of that was suddenly cut off. China spent 50 years outside that system and re-engaged. When it re-engaged, there was a flood. It was almost like a temporary dam burst and the rivers returned to normal. India is a different story. India is slowly growing into becoming a middle-income country. Not so slowly. I mean, 6% per year, something like that. And 6% we can actually trust, unlike the Chinese figures that we can't really believe. And it's a lot of opportunity for a lot of people, but primarily it's opportunity for Indians. It's organic growth. It's not a sudden recalibration of the world. Instead, it's organic growth within the global system, and we shall be happy for that, but I don't see any huge financial incentives for Australians to suddenly rush off to India.
Well, I appreciate your time today, and I found that absolutely fascinating. So thank you very much for sharing your insights with me and the channel, and I'll look forward to the next one.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks.